Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com. One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
I tell you what I want to open this podcast on. I want to say two words to you. Infinite wealth.
Yes.
A beautiful, perfect game. I know we need to get to things. I know this is the Untitled Banter podcast, the UBP, the UBP. The UBP! Everybody's sending in their various questions, talking points, etc. However, me and you have not talked that much about Like a Dragon, Infinite Wealth. So I thought, why not open the podcast on that? How are you finding it?
Pretty good so far. Pretty good. I haven't played that much within the last week, so you've probably caught up with me or maybe even overtaken me since we last spoke about it. But I love two things about it immediately. Is one of them actually is the immediacy of it, because the last game, and I think it's fairly common, as I understand, through the Yakuza series for games to take hours before they really start getting
good.
I think this one was a lot quicker than 7. And also, as the same with 7, just all the characters are so wonderful. And just like when you get a little group together at the beginning, like this is your starting party, you're like, I never want to split these guys up. They're all just wonderful. I'm having a lovely time wandering around Hawaii. There's a bunch of things on the map where it's like, you can go have a conversation about something that, you know, they're passionate about, something they did growing up or whatever. I've just been banging around like, oh, yeah, I want to have a chat with Chisose about, you know, whatever this. I just love that stuff to it.
Yeah, my thing is, like, the characters, I think, I really liked Kazuga in Yakuza 7. Yeah. I never finished Yakuza 7, mainly because of what you said. I felt like it took way too long to kick in, and I just sort of dropped off it. And I thought, at the when I was playing through that game, I thought that its attempt at doing the turn-based stuff, like, NPCs would get in the way when I was trying to do charge moves, whatever. Yeah. I just thought it was a bit cooked, even though I did love the story side of it and everything. And then I played the man who sold his name, whatever that one was.
Yeah,
where you play as Kiryu,
his own name.
Yeah, the man who was sick of it. And I played that thing. He had enough. And I played that, and there's a bit with Kazuga in there as well. And then Kazuga in Infinite Wealth is like phenomenal. And I just love this. The whole writing of that character is brilliant. I love how different he is from Kiryu, but he still has the whole Heart of Gold thing. And I'm just like you said, I'm just loving being Kazuga and then just having friends and walking around Hawaii.
That's great.
And I just wanted to shout that game out, because I did a tweet the other day where I was like, I don't know about you, but like for me, 2024 so far has beaten 2023, and we're only like a month and a bit in. And I get that. Part of me saying that because it's a over the top statement, but I do kind of feel it in my heart at the minute, because I've played Prince of Persia Lost Crown was phenomenal, and then Tekken 8 was phenomenal, and then Pal World was good fun, and then Infinite Wealth is phenomenal, and Helldivers 2 is phenomenal. Yeah. And I'm like, that run of games, to me at least, has already beaten the run of 2023.
I mean, obviously, the question is, can it maintain? And I think the answer is pretty clear that it's probably going to be a rockier year after a certain point. But in terms of a strong start to a year, yeah, that's pretty incredible.
Yeah, it's super solid. Well, that's the thing. Like, we've got this Final Fantasy in a few weeks, and then there's not that much else that's penciled in for the rest of the year. I mean, the Xbox thing, as we're recording this, the Xbox thing they did last night, the podcast announcement thing, they said they have more stuff to announce in June. So, assumedly, there's more things for that. But we'll get back around to that in a little bit. We'll do as many people's questions as we can. First one from Elfar Oliver, who says, what could possibly be a quadruple A game? Is it lifelike graphics? Is it the budget, the developer? Ubisoft said Skull and Bones is lol, but it's not on Switch. Also, is the Switch even a AAA console if it can't run AAA properly? Is GTA 6 going to be the first quadruple A game? Love you, keep it up. I think for this, I forgot that Skull and Bones was out. Like, that thing's out like today.
Yes.
It's a bit of a mess.
I mean, it doesn't help that it's been one of those games that has been kicking around every State of Play, Summer Games Fest, whatever, for what feels like a decade at this point. Like, it's just there every other year to remind you that it's coming, guys. So I'm not really surprised that there's not that bit many people talking about it on the lead up to release, because I don't know, it's been a long time coming. When it comes to quadruple A, I mean, the answer is very obvious. It's nothing. It's a made up marketing term. This is not a new term either. Ubisoft have been used, you know, batting this around for a good number of years now. Mm-hmm. It doesn't really mean anything. It's just to make you feel like this game's. I do it with lots of their games where, like, this is going to be the revolution. And it's just, maybe it's a good game, but it's not a, like a crazy next level thing. So, yeah, it's just a marketing gimmick, unfortunately.
Yeah, it reminds me of, because the Perfect Dark reboot was like, oh, it's going to be the world's first quadruple A game.
Yeah, it was Perfect Dark, yeah.
Yeah. But it's like, yeah, ultimately, what the hell does that mean? Like, it's a bit shinier. It takes even longer to develop. Like, it's not a thing. Like, it's just some way to make you turn your head. Another thing for that Xbox conference, I keep calling it a conference, the Xbox podcast last night was Sarah Bond mentioning that their next console is going to have the biggest hardware leap of any console ever or something. And it's like, there's nowhere else for you to go, really. I feel like we've hit the, you know, when thousands of people are losing their jobs trying to keep up with an industry at a certain production level, then you can't really go much higher than that. But I think for the quadruple A thing in Skull and Bones, that was because on the Ubisoft side, I think it was Yves Guillemot, the CEO, said that the game took so long because they were adding the extra A to it, and that's what this beautiful extra thing is. And it's like, when you look at it, it doesn't come across like it's this, you know, demonstrably better thing. I think they just needed a way to sell it. I mean, they're still selling it at full price. Like, if you dive into the game's development, there was a whole thing where they had a contract with the Singapore government to finish the game regardless of anything. And so I think, whatever, at some point they need to get something over the finish line. But for the game itself, I've not actually played it. I thought it looked pretty barren the way that it was rolling out. And then now seeing way more gameplay of it, they don't let you board ships as a pirate. Like, it's a pirate game, but you only do the combat and that's it. And if you only take someone's ship over, it just gives you a cutscene and then you can skip it and that's it. Oh. And I was like, surely the open goal for this was taking Assassin's Creed Black Flag and letting you fight other players as you jump across. And if someone's good enough, maybe they can defend their whole ship or whatever. And if you want to have your loot components and that kind of stuff, you know, you could get a better sword or whatever. And I know that they would monetize that stuff, but still, at least you would have the idea of, like, I'm a really good pirate on the open seas and right. I defend my ship and whatever. And they don't have any of that.
Obviously, like, from what I recall, the game was sort of announced or in development, obviously, alongside Sea of Thieves. So they're coming into a space where there's already a game that just, like, does everything I guess you could possibly want out of that. Mm-hmm. So to come in with, like, yeah, as you say, features that are not there that you just automatically would expect out of a pirate sim. Mm-hmm. Yeah, doesn't sound great.
No, and Sea of Thieves is one of the four games that's coming to PlayStation and Switch and whatever it is anyway. So, not according to Phil Spencer, who refuses to reveal the information that's been out there for a week.
Phil Spencer.
next question from John Larkin, who says, curious to hear your thoughts on the Final Fantasy VII Rebirth demo, especially after Scott tweeted that he didn't enjoy what they did to the Nibelheim incident. Me and you talked a little bit about this, but thoughts on the whole thing with Rebirth's demo?
I mean, I enjoyed it. I really loved playing the piano, shock horror, like rhythm games and that kind of thing. So,
same.
That was nice. And it's just one of those things where I love Final Fantasy VII so much that just playing Remake and now the beginning of Rebirth, I just love doing the Leonardo DiCaprio meme where I'm like, I know that bit, I know this thing, all this is different, and I'm just like verbally pointing this out to no one as I'm playing it and that kind of thing. It suffers with a lot of the same issues that Remake has. Squeeze through here, climb up this. I'm not as... I understand the claims of padding and stuff in Remake, but that doesn't necessarily affect me so much. But yeah, I don't know, mixed feelings. It got me... It didn't change my hype level for Rebirth. It didn't suddenly make me more excited. Not to say that I'm not looking forward to it, but it didn't make me go, oh my God, I have to have this.
That my thing is, like, it reminded me of the parts that I didn't like about Remake in terms of the squeeze throughs and, like you said, the padding, like that bit when you've got to hoover up the Mako juice with the big hoover. I was like, what the F are we doing? Like, what the is this? Like, I hate that stuff where I just feel like they've had to just pad it for the sake of it, like just try and make you play longer so that you justifies the price or whatever it is, and because we are stretching a game out to be 3, 4, 5 times the length that it was before, and it was already a big game anyway. And so it reminded me of those bits. Like, there's that bit at the end of Remake, and it's not a plot spoiler, but there's that bit where it's in like chapter 14 or something of 16. You're about to go along a walkway and then it falls away and you have to do a whole thing with like Hojo and the lab and everything else. And I was like, oh my God, we just don't need this. And the thing that I tweeted about for the Nibelheim incident was I hated that they added ostensibly QuickTime events to the Nibelheim sequence. Like, I didn't like the how slow Cloud was walking through God. That bit. Like,
I hate that in any game where it's like, this is essentially a cutscene, but just push forward to get through the cutscene. It's like, this is not gameplay and it's not a cutscene. No. It's some sort of weird in-between that I don't like.
It's from like I was going to say a generation, but like a certain time of AAA games when it was like that weird line between cinematics and we were experimenting with QuickTime events and whatever. Mm-hmm. And I just feel like slow walk sequences are one of the most ancient things you can do at this point. And so, yeah, the slow walk sequence where he's just taking forever to get anywhere. It's not on rails yet, but it's very, very slow. Then you're about to walk up to Sephiroth, something falls in front of you. It's like, oh my God, let me walk slowly around. Yeah. I hate that. And then you finally get to the Sephiroth sequence and it's a slow crawl, hold the shoulder buttons to crawl. And I was like, this just feels like it's almost like if you gave the original Final Fantasy VII just like an arbitrary Western devs approach to that sequence from like 2012 or something, and it's or like 2012, and it's like, let's just sort of, you know, quick time event this to death. Mm-hmm. And I thought they killed the pace, and like, but then like I'm too much of an asshole with the nitpicky stuff, because
I've got another one as well. I think you agree with this in the sense that I agree with you, and you were like, this is the perfect way to do a demo. Arguably, this is the perfect way to start Rebirth, since it's the beginning of the game. Once you get the full game, you can just carry on from the end of the demo if you played it. Mm-hmm. So that makes sense, and it wants to reintroduce you to how the game works. Then basically, your options are, I guess, just don't give me Sephiroth to play with, rather than do what you did. He should either be cleaving through enemies in one hit, or I shouldn't be able to use him at all. Like, they kind of tried to balance it, because you were still like, remember how to play the game, here's a tutorial, and now also you get to do it as Sephiroth. He is obviously way more powerful, but he wasn't at the crazy level that he should have been. It was just like,
that's the thing. I felt that in Remake, like the way that they're treating Sephiroth in this. Like in the original, you had the Calm flashback, and then at that point, you as Cloud have been doing like 10 points of damage, 15 points of damage, whatever it is. Sephiroth comes in, there's a dragon in the way. It's all like a horror sequence. The reveal is that it's a dragon in the way. And Sephiroth does like a 5,000 point cleave and just kills the thing. And it's like, it's just phenomenal. Yeah. And you're just having to like watch this guy, like, oh my God, like how the hell do I lead up to this guy?
As storytelling.
Yeah, and it's perfect, and it's so medium specific. And then in this one, it's like, you're going to control him, but he's still taking, like, you know, if you get hit from an enemy from the side, he like reacts to it and stuff. And it's like, no, what the hell? Like, no, you should auto dodge or something. Yeah. Like, I don't know. It was just that stuff I didn't like. And then it got to the Nibelheim sequence itself, like the burning and everything. And that's what I meant about being nitpicky, was like that bit where we know that the him standing in the flames scene is coming. And then to me, they shoot a side shot where he's like standing just in front of Cloud, and then it cuts to the bit where he's in the flames. And just my brain was like, well, he's not far enough forward to be in all the flames. Like, they're too far away.
Yeah,
so I was just, it's just all that stuff around. I am too close to the original. I was like this when The Last of Us TV show came out, where I'm just too close. I love the original too much. I'm that person that it used to be the paradigm or whatever, where like a book got adapted and the person who read the original text is picking out everything that was different. And I'm just too close to it. I love the original too much. And it's arguably just not for me, this remake trilogy, even though I am going
to,
you know, play through
to
it.
To give it, to sing its praises, the positives are, I felt like the tone was spot on. Like, they got the sort of pseudo horror part of that game pretty much down pat, and the music, there were multiple moments where I just stopped
the music's so good,
the music for a while, because it's great. So
I was like most of 2020 I was refreshing Spotify, googling, trying to find out, because the release date for the soundtrack didn't come out straight away, and I hope they're a bit more on it this time, although they said they've developed like, was it 600 or 400 more songs or something?
Goodness. Okay, so,
I mean, there's like 7 versions of the bombing run in the remake, and there's loads of versions of the Chocobo theme, but it's a hell of a ride to be on. I'm kind of waiting to see how things feel at the end of the third installment, like holistically, what does it feel like to, what does this trilogy feel like by the time we're done with it, and that'll be kind of where I ultimately have a judgment or something. But it's just rolled out in such a weird way, and because they had the Sephiroth fight at the end of Remake, and then we've got to go back and be like, oh, actually we need to chase him again, and it's just a weird story, but it seems to be going down really well. Like, people are loving it, and it's like, it's interesting talking to people who don't know the story. They're still like, Josh is loving it, and I'm like, he has no frame of reference, and it seems to be working way more than it's not. Question from Tarnished Yaz, who says, hello legends, what are the worst / best boss battles? Worst for me are when you're on a small platform and have to dodge constantly, waiting for the boss to rest a limb then attack and repeat, and the best are where you face a boss equal to you in size and skill, like Lady Maria in Bloodborne. I thought this was interesting because we do loads of like boss battle lists and stuff, but I don't think about boss battle types. Like, it started making me think about, we have a Resident Evil question later, but you know, Resident Evil, early Resident Evils, you've got tank controls, you're kind of like fundamentally outmaneuvered by a boss, and it's like, let's rotate around them and stuff. And like, thinking about that, I was like, but there is something in overcoming that's quite satisfying. But I don't know if you have like a favorite boss battle type.
That's hard. I mean, like, the obvious answer is just anything where it's kind of you know, use everything that you've learned, right? Prove yeah. that you've actually taken this in, combine all these disparate elements together mm-hmm. and overcome a challenge. That makes mm-hmm. the most sense. The worst is easy. and I've made this comment before, but, you know, anything that basically just relies on me waiting around for the opportunity to parry to win.
Right.
Like, yeah. let me actually get in there and make some decisions instead of just circling an enemy and then mm-hmm. having to block and parry. Does nothing for me, but, you know.
Yeah, I would back that. I think the one you said about, you know, a boss that makes you use everything you've learned to that point, that reminded me of like the final boss in Metroid Dread, or Prince of Persia was an immaculate version of that. You know, where you're like, I like a good sort of 2D boss fight where it's pixel specific, like you're mm-hmm. really dodging through those gaps and memorizing stuff, and then being able to get in that zone and like trade blows, parry like in the middle of that fight. I think for me, like I like a good one-on-one, but not in the Soulsian way. Like I get a bit sick of the one-on-one. Yeah. To me, that's Punch Out, which is great fun. But like, to me, it's like, it's the Devil May Cry stuff. It's DMC3's Virgil fights. And then it's also the Virgil fight in DMC5 at the very end, where like, it's just, you are fighting each other tooth and nail, but it's acrobatic and you're dodging and flying around. And you like part for a while, you go into a charge attack, something like that. Mm-hmm. Something a bit more kinetic than just a Soulsian thing. But yeah, I think boss battles at this point, I feel like they died off for a few years, and then it was like that idea of like the art of the boss battle kind of went away, and then Souls got mm-hmm. so big and Elden Ring and everything else that like now Picked they're up. Back
yeah.
and it's like
yeah, for sure.
it's it feels good. Question from the most lovey-dovey gunner, who says, is Nintendo about to righteously dunk on Sony/Microsoft with Xbox seemingly lost in its current state and PlayStation not releasing a major game for a whole year? I feel like Nintendo has the easiest slam dunk of all time if they show up with a new console.
I'm so curious about this because the Switch is obviously massive. I think literally yesterday the news just came out that it's the best-selling console of all time in Japan now.
Right, okay.
I think that's right. Don't quote me on that. But the point is, it's huge and everybody's got one. So it'll be interesting to see, less so what we as the sort of hardcore audience react to it, but what it does for the casual sort of audience. Are people just going to go, do people care about a more powerful Switch? Are they happy with what they've got casual-wise? Mm-hmm. Is that going to be enough of a difference for when Nintendo go, it's a Switch, but it's way more powerful? Obviously, it's also down to what the launch titles are going to be. Like, if they've got... if they're going to just cut the generation off here and be like, here are the exclusives, you have to get the Switch too, or mm-hmm. whatever... Yeah, it's going to be really interesting to see. They've got a massive opportunity here, but it depends on how people react to it.
Yeah, looking at the like Sony's financial conference thing the other day, where they don't have anything, they arguably don't have anything until the end of March 31st, 2025. It was like the next financial year is pretty much empty. But then you had some insiders like Jeff Grubb saying, like, well, they apparently have a new Astro Bot game they've got coming out, but they didn't. I'm there for that. That game is the best PS5 game. But but they were saying they don't have any major releases, so it is quite an empty slate. And then Xbox is, they're just a whole other thing at this point. They're like the Amazon Prime of gaming, and that's fine. But I'm curious what they do for this. There are leaks for the new Switch as well. Like, it's meant to be fully backwards compatible. It is meant to just be a gutsy,
please,
because that's apparently that's what they're offering, is like enhanced versions of existing games. I think it's gonna be interesting whether they charge for them. But last year, apparently, the Switch 2 was being shown off with an enhanced version of Breath of the Wild, so it seems like Zelda is like something it was developed around, which is cool. I'm just curious what the system is. I think for me, like, the more guts something has that's handheld, the more the battery dies in like an hour or 2 hours. Like, I have a Steam Deck, which I mostly just treat as an emulation machine, but that thing can't handle, you know, much in HD or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like, it's I'm using it for old stuff. but yeah, I think 2024, it's going to be a weirdly quite empty year. I think a lot of like post-pandemic stuff has needed to be sorted for a while, and then you're seeing that with like all the layoffs at Microsoft. Even Sony let people go from Insomniac. Like, they're planning for the pro version of the PS5, things like that. So I'll take a souped up Switch, but I want them to do right by the games that could show it off. Like, give me a new Star Fox, have Metroid Prime 4. Like, I don't need AAA from them necessarily if we're comparing it to Xbox and Sony, but I just want something that's like, because did you play Metroid Prime Remastered?
No, I bought it, I booted it, and I was like, I'll get back to you, and it's just on the shelf, unfortunately.
But still, like, the way that game looks, like, doesn't look like a Switch game. It looks next-gen kind of thing. It looks beautiful. There's so many little, you know,
Metroid Prime 4 feels like the obvious, given it's been so silent on it. That seems like a great opportunity to kick a new console off. As I say, for us, sort of more hardcore gamers, maybe. And I tweeted this the other day. I think it's been 6 or 7 years since Mario Odyssey now. So
2017.
Yeah. So depending on when that was in the year, mm-hmm. yeah, it's probably about time for a new 3D Mario, which seems like a logical system seller for a wider audience as well.
Yeah, well, I think they delayed the new Switch, like, because the rumor doing the rounds at the minute is that they were hanging back to see what the Xbox podcast thing was going to be last night, and apparently there's a direct that's like ready to go, which we'll probably get next week, and apparently the hardware reveal is either during that or straight after that. So there is that. So maybe this time next week we'll know. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that whole thing about them launching with Zelda and Mario, I loved that as like the two pillars of the system, like the blue and the red, like Link's tunic and then Mario's like iconic color kind of thing. And then they almost ended it with Tears of the Kingdom and Mario Wonder last year.
Yeah.
But then to me, it was like you push it back a whole year. And that's the thing, like right now, Mario versus Donkey Kong is out, but it's like it's a remake of a Game Boy Advance game, like whatever. And there's not that much. It feels like they're sort of just waiting until they can do the next big step.
It's really cool that there's a new Princess Peach game, definitely.
Totally.
But
that
is kind of indicative of sort of late console generation. Like they've used a lot of their major IP at this point, so they're just kind of like, it's like, yeah, we got these spare parts, you know, while we're developing the next.
Like, we might as well.
Whatever, yeah, so.
Yeah, the Princess Peach game looks awesome, but I thought it would play more like, you know, 3D Kirby or like the Jack, like Jack 2 and Jack 3, like the Jack and Daxter sequels, where it's like almost isometric, but you're running around shooting stuff. I just love the version of Peach that's in the Mario and Rabbids games. Give her a massive shotgun and let her like be like, you know, just fully artillery Peach. Like, I love that version of her. And like, same with the one that's in the Mario movie, where she's like got martial arts and she kicks ass and everything, and it's like I thought we were going to get that, like almost like a brawler version of a Peach game. And I think that there are martial arts costumes you can put on her in the new game, but still, like, yeah, the fact that it's like a 2D runner is fine, but I thought it would be more crazy than what they've shown. Question from Jack Asbury, who says, is it nice to be pleasantly surprised by a game like Helldivers 2 than have your worst fears confirmed? Also, one for Sai, if I wanted to get into the Resident Evil series, would I be better off playing the original games or the remakes?
I mean, let's do this in order. The first one, yes, I think, obviously. It's nice.
Good things are good.
Good things are good, yeah, basically is what that comes down to. And shout out to Ewan, by the way. I'm sure he's probably already kind of, I told you so'd about Helldivers, but he really, he was telling us that this is going to be huge. And I think it's actually outdone his expectations as well, which is great. It looks awesome. I'm very, very tempted. I know
you should play it. Like, it's in regards to the game itself, Ewan was like the only person calling this game. I feel like all of us were like, nah, it's a live service thing.
I saw it and it was like, yeah, it looks kind of fun, as basically is, but yeah, I don't think anybody was expecting it to be the game that everyone is talking about.
No, like, I saw, like, this morning, I was like, I think it had over, was it 225 or 250,000 players on Steam, and it's like the number 39th most played game on Steam ever or something.
Wow.
And it's doing really well. I mean, it's really cool on, to see a small team blow up so much. Like, Arrowhead haven't had a game since 2015. And it's been cool, like, how sort of, you know, community-driven they've been. I tagged the CEO and the composer and people like that in a tweet, and thankfully they replied. It's like awesome to see that. And I think they're very aware of like how much they're blowing up. Like, they've put a hiring call out so they can get more staff, because the CEO, I think it's Herman Palstad, was saying that like they've had sleepless nights. They're just trying to get the servers working. Like, it's hard to make this thing stay up. So it's really cool when you see something like that. Like, this and Palworld have been like the two big success stories of the year.
Really good news, because one of the sort of early reviews or previews of Helldivers I saw expressed some concern about the depth of the content at launch and the fact they hadn't announced any roadmap or anything. But the fact that they're hiring staff means that they are reacting to this massive popularity. Hopefully they can continue that by putting out some updates and stuff in the future.
Mm-hmm. The community side of it's awesome, but I love that they have this like wider framework of like, if you follow the official Helldivers Twitter, they do like little mini news reports, because everyone is contributing to like the same war effort. So like, we all quote unquote collectively overthrew one of the planets that was filled with bugs like a couple of nights ago.
Nice.
And then right now Earth is about to be attacked by the automatons, so like, you're encouraged to log on, do your part, try and repel the automatons. And there's a specific mission type that only triggers when a planet is under attack, and that's what's active like as we're recording this. Like, Earth is under attack by the automatons, and I'm like, that's really fun. Like, no live service game, as far as I know, has gone one to one with its story like that.
Or its
wider sort of framing like that. And it's a really cool thing. It's like, if they can keep that up whilst if they maintain the servers and everything else, then you know, why not dive on and do your part for a bit? And it's
they
like, that's a fun
leaning
thing to do.
Really hard into the Starship Troopers thing with that.
Oh god, yeah.
As someone who watched that for the first time this week, and it was great, by the way.
Oh really? Okay.
Yeah, that's a big part of the narrative of that film, is like the news reports and all that kind of stuff. So that's very clever.
I haven't played that since I was like five. Sorry, I haven't watched that since I was like five. I watched that way too young, and I need to go back to
it. I think
it,
I saw bits of it on TV, you know. I don't think I've actually sat and watched it from front to back. And yeah, it's great. Holds up really well.
I was life scarred by it.
I'm surprised.
Yeah, that Resident Evil question, though. If someone was going to start out, originals or remakes?
So I think the answer is probably the remakes, just for the quality of life, the ease of access, that kind of thing. What I would actually probably say is, if you've never played or played very little Resident Evil games, maybe start with the 2002. We call it in the original community, we just call it remake, as in capital E R, capital E remake. So the remake of the original game. Give that a go first, because I think that will inform sort of where you go from there, because it's fixed camera angle, tank controls, that kind of thing. The HD remaster, which is the version that's available everywhere, it's on Game Pass and whatever. I think it might be called Resident Evil Origins, maybe, or whatever.
Okay.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Before we go any further, I want to talk to you about today's sponsor, Masterclass. With the amount of time we spend discussing and analyzing video games on this channel, it's always good to understand exactly how these experiences are put together. And fortunately for me, I can do just that with Masterclass. With Masterclass's streaming service, you can learn from the best to become your best, studying and growing with over 200 plus of the world's leading instructors. For me, I've been having a blast using a class on video game design by The Sims creator Will Wright to find out exactly how game mechanics are designed around player psychology, as well as learning how important playtesting is to shipping the titles that you and I both love. But it hasn't stopped there, as I've also been brushing up on my practical filmmaking skills directly from my favourite movie director, Martin Scorsese, as well as trying to get back in the cooking game with Roy Choi's amazing course on intuitive cooking. Seriously, my kitchen is a mess, but my belly has never been more grateful. For just $10 a month, an annual membership with Masterclass gets you unlimited access to courses on your phone, computer, smart TV, or even via audio-only modes. Even better, every new membership comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, and 88% of members feel that the service has made a positive impact on their lives. And to put the cherry on top of that cake, right now, What Culture Gaming listeners get an additional 15% off any annual membership at masterclass.com/gaming. That's 15% off at masterclass.com/gaming. What's that? You want it one more time? Well, that's the URL, masterclass.com/gaming. Right, now I'm going to watch Tony Hawk try to teach me how to ollie properly. I'll see you all soon.
It does have a different alternative control scheme to make it easier if you're not getting on with the fixed.
Is that the one where you can run in any direction?
Kind of thing. It doesn't make sense to my brain, because I played this game when it came out, obviously, so it's weird to do that. But it makes sense to people that are not used to tank controls, definitely. Mm-hmm. Give that a go first, and depending on how you get on with that, I think that might maybe inform your decision more. Because the original games, you know, they are classics. I think the narrative depth of those games is better. The remakes, I mean, they're just easier to play. They're just more available. And they are wonderful games in their own right. I'm not going to say they're bad games at all.
No, yeah.
But my preference is originals, but that comes from being a super nerd, you know, and a lot of nostalgia.
I think for us, like, we grew up with these games. So I think for me, it's interesting when you think back on the whole series where it's like you've got three different strands to Resident Evil. You've got like the isometric tank control stuff. It's like super atmospheric and like really like, but the pace is so different because it's more puzzle based. You've got bits of combat, but for me, I would always get hurled up on the puzzles. And then you've got the over shoulder stuff, which is like RE4 onwards, and they remaster the originals to be like that. And then the first person stuff, which is like RE7 and RE8. So to me, it's almost like, what kind of game do you like playing?
Yeah.
And then can you square that against what you should be playing? If you want to know what Resident Evil is all about, then it would be the tank control stuff and get stuck into the old ones.
Yeah, for sure. The thing is like, don't be immediately turned off the whole series by one experience. You feel about, for example, the 2002 Resident Evil remake, play Resident Evil 2 remake afterwards. Like, that's probably the most accessible game out of the lot in terms of the one that you're most likely to fall in love with and potentially sort of determine your opinion on the series at large. Definitely try a couple of games, because like you say, there's so many different kinds of Resident Evil. Resident Evil is so many things now at this point.
There's also like, I love Revelations 2, like a co-op version of
asymmetrical co-op. I love it.
Yeah, and it's like they have really good like level layouts where you're helping each other through puzzles and stuff. And it's like, if you're looking to play it, like, you know, have a first experience of Resident Evil with someone else, then I guess you should do Resident Evil 1, but at the same time, 2 is like quite easy to just
They're not really
into.
Connected, so it doesn't matter too much really what order you play them in. There's not really anything that ties those games together other than this is the side story sort of series. They're not really related. So,
I like the Saw movie style trapping of Revelations 2 as well. Like, you're in that one facility, you've got that person watching you. It's almost like a wider sort of framing for that. Question from Matthew McGowan, who says, who is the best NPC in gaming history and why is it the merchant from Resident Evil 4?
He's up there. Do you know, I have the reason we talked about Infinite Wealth at the beginning of this. The reason I haven't been playing that much is because we did the RE4 VR challenge thing on our YouTube channel. If you haven't watched that, it's a great laugh.
Please go check it out. Yeah.
I had dipped into VR a little bit with PSVR before, but it was the first time playing a Quest. And then immediately afterwards, I just fell in love with the damn thing. So I got home and bought one for myself. So I've been playing Resident Evil 4 VR. And man, that merchant, he's a lot uglier than you think he is when you get up close. He's a creepy looking dude. Don't like him at all.
If when he opens his coat, can you like lean in and be like, oh, I see what you've got?
Yeah, he's like, got like a magnum there and all this stuff. And you're like, oh, okay. But it's terrifying because you'll like leave the... When you talk to him, it obviously goes to like an external menu. When you come back, he can be right up in your face. It's terrifying. He's up there. Him and Ashley are up there as the scariest things in the game, literally just because you can turn around and they're there in your face. And you're like, you know, wasn't expecting that. Screw the monsters. It's just, you know, Ashley's terrifying enough. Mm-hmm. He's up there for me for NPCs. That's a really tough question. And also Resident Evil, Marvin Branagh, the cop that dies at the beginning of Resident Evil 2, remake specifically, he's great in that.
I've got a controversial pick for the best NPC, which I remember as a kid, I loved this character. And as I got older, I realized that everybody hated them. But I love Daxter from Jack and Daxter.
Like, sassy little boy.
Yeah, like this sassy little weasel man. Like, I love that. And like, he's always having a go at the Sage, like at the beginning. And like, I like all of his one-liners and everything. There's one bit where you take a mission from like another NPC who's like crying about their squad being wiped out or something. And then Daxter's like, because they talk about the enemies and how formidable they are. And Daxter says something like, well, did you try attacking with your melodrama? Because it's killing me. And like, young me was loving that sass. I was all over it. So I'll go Daxter, but I think that, but then as I grew up, I was like, oh, people hate Daxter and wished he would shut up and everything else. Which is also fair enough. But in regards to the RE4 merchant, it's got to be the original RE4 merchant, not the remake one. Unless you've softened on it. I was always a fan of the original.
I'm all right with both. I like the sort of Cockney twinged version.
That is fair. Question from Bam, who says, good day. What's a game that you enjoyed at first but like less and less on subsequent playthroughs? Wish you wonderful folks all the best. I've got another controversial pick for this. This question in. It's The Last of Us 2, Si. It's The Last of Us 2. Enjoyed my time through it, but ever since finishing it, I keep trying to go back to it. I've been like, I should probably replay it. Like, it's this masterpiece thing. I'm all right. Played it once. Don't need it again.
Yeah, I mean, that is actually on the long list of games I probably should have played but haven't. And I started it at the sort of tail end of last year, and then they announced there was going to be the pay a five or ten or whatever it is to get the upgrade for PS5. And I was like, okay, maybe I'll just put it on hold and see what happens. Turns out that upgrade's kind of pointless, as it seems. So at some point, I will get back to it. So I don't really have, obviously, an opinion on that. I talked about how I feel about The Last of Us. One, not really.
It's just omnipresent at this point. I will shout out as well, the Grounded 2 documentary is really good. They finally passed it into the game, but it's like a full-on two-hour behind-the-scenes documentary of how they made The Last of Us 2. That's
sounds
phenomenal.
Great, yeah.
And it's like, that's the thing where I'm at. I'm like, I can appreciate the franchise from a distance. Yeah. I just, for me, Last of Us is one phenomenal game, and it was done. I didn't need you to answer the open-ended questions that gave us great talking points at the end of that game. But that would be mine. It's just that thing of like, getting through the game, loving my time with it, but as soon as I hit the credits, I was like, I don't think I needed that. And then it's just sitting with that for the last 4 years. It hasn't really shifted, even though I appreciate it and everything else. But do you have a game that you love like less since you've played through it again?
I don't know. That's a really hard question. I try not to play the same game multiple times necessarily, because like I said, if I've got like a I should play this list, but I haven't yet, and it includes The Last of Us 2, I'm doing something wrong. I should stop playing the same game and get through that list. So I don't actually know if I've got one, you know. I'm sure there is.
That's
somewhere.
Good.
If I was in front of my entire collection, I could probably root out something that I've played, and then over time I look back on that experience and be like, probably wasn't as good as I thought it was.
I think, there's like, it's rare that you would keep going though. Like if you end up going back through something and it's not hitting, like it's like, well, why would I keep going with this? It's a hard question. People can get in touch on social media, let us know which games were worse the second time you went through them. Jack Jingle asks, been reminiscing about Game Facts after going on recently to look something up about Golden Sun, which they'd recommend. How much effort did people put in for free content back then? Those text-based images of cover art must have been a grind. Never mind the overall detail in the old guide versions. Not necessarily a question, but I wanted to include this. Yeah, I remember the age of Game Facts.
Oh, yeah.
And just like shout out to all the heroes that would put like entirely text-based versions of entire game guides together. What year, like 2006, 2005?
Maybe even earlier than that. Yeah, for sure.
But that was, yeah, for me, like I don't know if you remember IMDb's forums as well, but like they got rid of them after a while. But just early online culture of like trying to find forums, trying to find discussion stuff. I just wanted to include that. You have Game Facts memories as well.
Yeah, absolutely I do. There's something like, you know, obviously now if you get stuck in a game, you literally just can YouTube it. But there's, which is really handy, obviously. But there's something different between I'm watching someone play it successfully and now I'm going to emulate that compared to someone's written an entire guide. And if you're growing up, you find that guide and you're like, this person's clearly an expert. Why would they have written this guide? They must be the master at this game, because otherwise they wouldn't be able to write this guide. So I'm going to trust this. There was something deeper about that and something a bit more, I don't know. It's obviously a bit more than just watching a bit of a YouTube clip and being like, oh yeah, okay.
there's a whole art to it. Like a lot of people got jobs off of that stuff as well. Like you got hired for websites and years ago, we attempted to do some more guide-based coverage right at the beginning, 2013, 2014, when I came on board. But hardly any of those things stayed as guides. They ended up just becoming like, well, if we're talking about this interesting part, then separate that out. But guide writing is still a big thing, even though personally I would do what you do. I'd check YouTube instead. But I've got a stupid funny thing for this. Like when I used to get guidebooks with gaming magazines, and I used to just read through them. Like I used to just read through the plot. I finished the game, then I'd read through it. Or like I remember like talking to, I think it was like a doctor, a GP at the time, going like, well, are you doing enough reading? Because you're playing a lot of games. And I was like, yeah, I'm doing enough reading. I've got the Resident Evil 2 guidebook
I
don't need novels.
I have almost exactly that same experience.
Oh, really?
Yeah, just I was like, not. I was thinking, here I go again, talking about Resident Evil. Like, come on, just find another subject. But yeah, same thing. I was so addicted to Resident Evil 2 that I remember printing off the guide. It was just like, room name, do this in the room, and then go to room name, do this in that room. And I took that to school when I was reading it. I remember being like, one of those things every now and then was like, talk about what you're reading. It was just you and the teacher. It wasn't in front of the class. You have to read some of it to them. And I wound up reading some of the Resident Evil 2 guide. I was probably like 12 or something.
Yeah.
Not old enough to legally, quote unquote, play the game or whatever. So such a weird specific. I wonder how many other people out there listening to this are now going, oh my God, I remember printing off and being taken to school and stuff like that.
Well, like for printing stuff off, that reminds you, like, printing off all the wrestler, creator wrestler codes for, like, old SmackDown games.
Making Ninja Turtles in SmackDown 2.
Yeah, or, like, making the roster members who weren't on the official release or whatever. But, yeah, that whole thing of how much effort people used to put into those games, like, those guides and stuff before they became a bit more expected, I guess, like, before it became a feature of game sites and stuff. Shout out to all those people. If you, GameFAQs, I think, is still live. Yeah, but I imagine a lot of those text ones will still be live. Back then as well, you would have to look for the, because it had the data size, the file size next to each one, so I would always look for the one that was like like it's only like 190 kilobytes, like it's nothing, but that was like the whole game. That's how you'd be able to weed it out.
Yeah, I love that. And like, just also, since we're reminiscing, just the era of that was like the era of fan sites, where people would make whole websites dedicated to a series, or you don't really get websites that people have made about just something they love anymore, because social media is such a big part of the internet. But before, it used to be, you know, here's my entire website about Metal Gear Solid. It's here's the character profiles that I've written, and
the custom animations.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
Music
that I was gonna say, like little GIFs and stuff that people have animated, and just pages of that stuff, like really ugly, nasty, like GeoCities and Angel Fire websites. But
everything
just
had sparkles on it.
Yeah, but it was created with such, you know, earnest feeling. We just don't get that anymore.
Like, that reminds me of when people realized on MySpace you could code MySpace, and it was like I used to have like a little mini pool game in there where you could, if you wanted my profile, you could play pool. And it's like, in a different reality, I feel like if MySpace was MySpace gaming from the beginning, and you could put little mini games in there or whatever, maybe there's like a version of social media that would have just been for the gamers, and all those kind of websites would have been our profiles or something. But yeah, it's a good point. Like that, level of fandom is just kind of, I don't know, like mushed into social media or a Reddit page.
People just make pages on Facebook to like or whatever now, don't they? So, you know, groups join.
It's, I've never, Facebook's a weird one because I feel like that was everywhere. And then I feel like I disconnected from it. And then I keep, every now and then, like Josh will tell, people are on Facebook again. And I'm just like, is that, are we all returning to Facebook and I'm not aware of this? Like, I refuse to go back. I'm at the end of Lost. But question from Eyeball Paul, who says, do you think if Jim Ryan had worn a couple of gaming t-shirts, he would be held in the same held in the same esteem as Phil Spencer? Spencer's record number of redundancies and consistently subpar first-party game launches would normally be a cause for criticism, but for many, he remains the messiah. This is a hell of a loaded question, but
I think it's
initial thoughts.
It's a charisma thing is all it comes down to, isn't it? Like, it's just that's the difference maker. Jim Ryan's just quite a dry individual, especially compared to compared to Phil Spencer, who it might be a bit cringy, but he still feels a little bit like a college bro sometimes in his sports jackets and that kind of, you know. So I do understand why people, it's a weird thing inside of us to be able to just like, he's all right, really.
I think the thing is with the Spencer stuff is like, he was coming in after Don Matrick messed everything up.
There's
like, you had Don Matrick, you know, like tried to change the very idea of what an Xbox is, which you can argue that's what they're doing right now. But like, the Matrix stuff went sideways. Spencer came in, he talked like someone who played games, and then he had the stats to prove it. He's like, here's my profile, I play everything. People would share instances of meeting him in online games and stuff like that. Like, it seemed like he actually cared, which was the polar opposite of Don Matrick.
Yeah.
And then he's only kind of gone from strength to strength, at least in that regard, since then. And then if you compare him to Ryan, like, you have Jim Ryan coming in after, I think it was after Sean Layden, who was the guy that helped get Crash Bandicoot back together. And like, Layden was, it seems like, a pretty down-to-earth gamer guy who at least will talk to you about why games matter. Whereas Jim Ryan's earliest quotes were him slagging off the original Gran Turismo, saying like, well, who would want to play that today? And I know he said that he meant it wouldn't release today.
Yeah.
But still, there's ways to approach that. And so like, it was quite easy to sort of diametrically oppose them. And I think like, Spencer always came out as like, what someone who knows what they're talking about and plays a lot of games might do if they were given the power to run a company, as opposed to Jim Ryan being a very cold stats guy. And a very specific, and you're also like, we're comparing like a 2 or 3 year tenure to like 10 years.
Yeah.
And it was very easy for Jim Ryan to come across cold, and he didn't really seem to have many redeemable aspects. Like, a lot of his conferences were just pretty flat, pretty boring. The Sony's era under Ryan was just so unmemorable. Like, there's not any big E3 reveals. There's not any big sort of, hey, we're bringing this character back. Like, he just didn't care because he didn't need to. They can just sit back and make all
the money. He wasn't engaged with that kind of stuff. Absolutely right. Like, he wasn't at the forefront of like, we're doing this cool thing, generally speaking. And like, so there was no, and you just said about like first impressions almost out there. Phil Spencer comes in, he's like, I'm a gamer and all this, and look at me, I'm smiling, I'm warm. Where Jim Ryan comes out and says, ow, games are bad or whatever, you know, like, it's not a great first impression. But he just didn't, it seemed like he didn't care about trying to win that favour back at all. Mm. He was just a business guy, whereas Phil Spencer, was the opposite completely. Mm-hmm. Or at least presented as the opposite, I guess.
Yeah, totally. Like, it's interesting as well looking at, like, you know, there's obviously a reality to Phil Spencer that needs to tick all the boxes of being an executive. And, like, you can see it in that Xbox podcast. Like, I assume they would have rehearsed that whole thing quite a lot. But, like, when he gets asked a question, he's like, oh, good question. Let me talk about that. It's like, you get that sort of PR way that people come across. I would recommend to people on Giant Bomb, it would have been about 10-ish years ago, maybe 8 years ago, Phil Spencer sat down with Jeff Gerstmann and did a really good just sitting on the couch talking about the state of Xbox interview, where you get a really good feel for what he's like when he's more relaxed. And he knows his stuff, but it's like at a certain level of like executive boardroom stuff, that is just how they talk. And I think that it's interesting watching him have to deal with that over the years and get bigger and bigger and bigger. And now he's like the head of Microsoft Gaming and everything. And he needs to hold himself in a certain way. But yeah, I think that as a direct comparison, it was like Phil Spencer just seems like he knows what he's talking about a bit more than Ryan, and it wasn't just naked money moves, which, you know, like the live service Sony stuff is all, that's all Jim Ryan, and we're still sort of dealing with that, even though I love Helldivers 2. So we'll see how things go. Question from Ben Petit, who says, which game had the biggest impact on you, even if it's not necessarily the best? Mine is Final Fantasy 15, as it oozed nostalgia and refreshed my love for the series and its music. Since then, I've been to four Final Fantasy themed concerts and replayed all my Final Fantasy childhood favorites.
Mine's, probably Rock Band 2.
Nice! What a pick!
Or maybe specifically Rock Band 1, I guess, which seems like it does feel like a weird one, but it has an impact on me that's wider than sort of gaming tastes. Like, it did absolutely kind of confirm to me that I'm into rhythm games and stuff, which is why I think 2-3 weeks ago on this very show, I was talking about Clone Hero, and now that I've got a VR headset, I've been playing Beat Saber all week, shock. but Rock Band for me, like, it just came at the right time, just sort of post school, college. Some of my friends were getting full-time work, some of them were going away. It was something that kind of kept us all together, and every house party there was Rock Band.
Same.
Just like, it was just this thing that just rolled on for a couple years, and I cared about it deeply in different ways. Like, I cared about I'm getting 100% and all this stuff, but also just like, yeah, as a thing that kept us together and friends and something social for us to do, it had a big impact as well. And also, before that point, I hadn't really sung in front of people, and then like the first day we had Rock Band, I was just like, the microphone was thrusted at me and I was like, oh no, okay. And then that just became my role, and it's like, it's something that I just enjoy doing for fun.
Yeah, definitely.
So, like, yeah, Rock Band's a big part of that as well. So when people always talk about, you know, top five, top three games, I kind of have to go, yeah, Rock Band 2 is in there, which is maybe a little bit weird, but, like, it has...
No,
it's because of that impact.
Yeah, mine's honestly the exact same. House parties, same time period, everyone's leaving, some people are moving to different places, but we get back together for Rock Band nights, order takeaways and play Rock Band. Like, that was such a time. Like, I know that obviously it bloated too much, and it was like, you can pinpoint when it died. It was when Band Hero came out, and then we suddenly had way too many of the same type of games.
Yes.
But Rock Band 2 was like the apex, like going into 3 and then Guitar Hero tried to do their thing and whatever. But like, in terms of an impact, like, that stuff reminded me or reinforced that I could actually learn an instrument, that I would, I'm putting so much time into the plastic instruments, I'm just going to start playing properly. And that started around about Guitar Hero 2, but it was definitely like alongside the other ones. And then learning drums with Rock Band, you actually do learn timing, you learn proper skills, and hand-eye coordination, everything through that. So yeah, I can only echo that so much. My mind went to Celeste, because I took this question as like a personal revelation thing or something, even though I actually echo the Final Fantasy stuff from last year, because I played so many of them as well. But Celeste, like, that game's depiction of sort of depression, anxiety, learning to live with those feelings or understand them and treating them as like almost another person to kind of, if you could talk to those feelings, what would they sound like? And trying to become one overall, and the strength that comes from understanding. That game fundamentally helped me understand someone who is a very, very close family member who was going through things at the time. And it just helped. It was just a framing device. And Celeste is a beautiful game.
Yeah,
like, if awesome. People haven't played it, that game's awesome. But its underlying sort of thematics and its messaging is like, unbelievably helpful in regards to just certain conditions, certain ways of getting through the day, mental health depictions, etc. So I would go with that. A final question from Paul McSoul, who says, "Hello UBP, I've been watching too many Ancient Aliens lately, and I was wondering, what is your favorite depiction of alien life in gaming? Is it Mass Effect, Halo, XCOM? Also, are we alone in the universe?"
goodness.
this is a pivot that only the UBP can pull off.
Absolutely, right. No, I don't think so in regards to the last one. Statistically speaking, I'm
Do you think there's something
I'm a believer.
There?
Yeah, I'm a believer.
Nice.
I'd like to be open-minded about all of that in general. Is this an appropriate place to have a weird side tangent about the paranormal? I am hopefully people will enjoy this story. So I had a knock on my door yesterday, and I opened the door to this rather tiny Chinese woman who was like, okay, and she was like, oh, I'm moving in next door, place has been empty for a couple months. She was asking a question about where did she park, where her parking spot in the area is, blah blah blah, just sort of that kind of thing. It was nice to meet her and stuff. And then just randomly out of nowhere, she goes, have you had any issues with spirits? Because my house is literally, there's a green in front of my house and then over a fence is a cemetery. And I was like, what? And then she pointed in that direction. I was like, oh, and she was really embarrassed to say, I'm afraid of ghosts. I didn't realize that was here when I was looking at the place originally. I'm kind of terrified to move into this house. I've not had any experiences like that really in my life at all. But, you know, I said to her, you don't have to be embarrassed about that. I would love to have that experience. I would love to have that. So, but no, unfortunately, or fortunately for you, no spirits. Mm. What was the question? Sorry.
Well, the question was aliens. Being alone in the universe.
Halo for me, but I think they said Halo. Halo is a great example. And also because it's such a, when you get deep into sort of the alien society within Halo, the Covenant, like all these different groups that come together, and they're all basically just told, they're all buying a lie, essentially. They're all in it for this holy prophecy, this holy war. They want to get a hold of the Halos because it's going to lead them to prosperity, and it's all a big jip, really. So I think that's very applicable to humanity right now as well, with a lot of negative information. So that's really hitting home at the moment. But I love Halo's sort of different structure of all the different alien societies, how they've all discovered each other and interlocked, and
No, same. I think like some of the best sci-fi is always, like, I love philosophy. I love why do we think the way we do, etc. And like some of the best sci-fi will frame that, you know, in ways that like regular fiction can't or whatever. I think for me, I like a nice variety of aliens. I would have said Mass Effect because I do love like all the parallels to our own, like, you know, the Quarians are like a nice depiction of like Eastern religion or whatever. And it's like, they're really good. But I think as a variety of aliens, I probably would go XCOM because you do have like the big brutes and like some of the more, I forget what you call the ones that have like the little pincers, but you have such a variety of like the aliens overall. So for me, if we're gonna go like, what do I want from alien designs, it's something that shouldn't look from this earth. I want it to be like some weird design and not just be bipedal like the most of the Mass Effect races are. As opposed to being alone in the universe, I'll go with this is such a boring answer, but I'm like, no, because in regards to like the probability of some sort of like even amoebic life form being out there, I can commit to that, but I don't think it's ever going to be something like what Paul looked like in that Simon Pegg Nick Frost movie. Or, you know, like we've taken the idea of aliens and made all these crazy ships, and they can fly and they can do all these things.
When we make contact, they're going to be really upset with us. They're like, this is what you were expecting. Come on, guys.
Exactly. And it's like, for me, it's like, I don't doubt that there's, I think there are already like quote unquote life confirmed on like Mars, but it's like, we're talking about a cellular, like, it's going to look like a half-made pancake at the most. Like, you know, that's what I can commit to in terms
nice
of saying something else is out there.
It was Shrove Tuesday this week.
It was a great week. It was a great, I've been eating aliens all week long. But I still think that, I can go that far with it. But it's like, it depends what people think is, if there's a whole civilization out there kind of thing. Like, I like the idea of on a big enough, you know, space, like infinite space, something else like us is out there. And I like the movie, I think it's called Another Earth, where I can't think of who's in it, but it's from a few years ago, where they look up and they see another Earth, and it's it's on a trajectory with our Earth, and it's what our civilization does, realizing there's going to be a contact, and then who's actually on that Earth and whatever. And that's a cool movie. But I guess we're not alone. But even if we're surrounded by a galaxy of pancakes, at least they're working towards something. They're getting there. But speaking of getting there, this has been the Untitled Banter Podcast, the EVP, the UBP, the UBP. UBP. Ivan Scott Tilford, that's been Cy White.
Thanks, Scott.
Thanks so much
the ending's
for joining
awkward,
in.
Isn't it?
you got to find some way to end the thing. But thank you to everybody for sending in your various questions. You can find a question over, it'll probably be next Thursday on the Twitter, asking people whatever they'd like us to submit for next week. But thank you all very much for listening, and we'll catch you soon. Goodbye.
Bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.